is there space for someone like me who would consider themselves to be a liberal in country music? And if so, where is that?
Are you talking as a performer or as a listener?
Oh, I would love to be a performer. But for now, baby steps, a listener.
Welcome to Deep Dive with me, Sean Fettig. I'm a political scientist, and I'm interested in how our governments and our politicians influence our lives, but also how our personal stories influence our politics. In this podcast, I may focus on topics in the news, but this is not punditry. Instead, I dive deep into issues and stories with my guests, behind the headlines, beyond the basic narrative that's often crafted by the media and our politicians, to help us better understand each other and why we think and feel the ways we do. I have a confession to make. I am a country music fan, or at least I was. When I was growing up in the 80s, I was exposed to country music from a very specific era, a throwback to the 70s, and that was limited to people like Emmylou Harris, Dolly Parton, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and one-off songs by folks like Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, and Kenny Rogers. And then in the 80s, I was listening to Reba McEntire, Randy Travis, The Judds, and Juice Newton, who's interesting in her own right for transitioning from pop to country. And frankly, I still think Juice Newton's music is unique and fantastic. But as I got older, and now we're talking into my teens, grunge and alternative music became popular. And I was there for it. I was Pearl Jam, The Cure, Stone Temple Pilots, 10,000 Maniacs, Sinead O'Connor, Paul Westerberg, Bodine's, Bare Naked Ladies. I could go on. At this time, I was also kind of figuring out who I was, how I wanted to present myself, who I was drawn to, and frankly, country music just wasn't a scene I felt particularly safe in anymore. New country music, at the time, felt very aggressive and confrontational, and the people listening to it were, well, these were not my people. So for a long time, I gave up on country music. Fast forward to January of this year. My spouse and I bought a turntable, and we have been ransacking secondhand vinyl stores since. And I'm finding a lot of the old country music that I used to love. And I'm finding stuff I've never listened to before, like Loretta Lynn and Charlie Pride, Tammy Wynette, Conway Twitty, Kitty Wells and Buck Owens. Reconnecting with a time when it felt like country music was much more focused on lifting up the downtrodden or giving voice to the powerless. This music means something to me. And there's a cognitive dissonance here because I still have the visceral memory of a really aggressive guy in high school in 1995 charging down the wrong way of a one-way street in an oversized pickup truck screaming anti-gay slurs at kids standing on the sidewalk, all to the soundtrack of some super loud country song. And it's got me wondering what happened in country music. Just drawing on my own impressions, it feels like country music evolved from being a place of refuge, maybe even reverence, for the poor and the powerless, to being a home for aggressive, confrontational, nativist conservatism. So I found a rabbit hole. And in that rabbit hole, I found two books that unpack this phenomenon, the political evolution of country music. One is Proud to be an Okie, Cultural Politics, Country Music, and Migration to Southern California. And the other is I'd Fight the World, a political history of old-time, hillbilly, and country music. Both are written by Dr. Peter LaChapelle, and that's who I'm talking to today. In addition to writing these fantastic books, Dr. LaChapelle is a professor at Nevada State University. He researches and teaches U.S. Western, political, and social history. He's written for The Washington Post, Pop Matters, and History News Network. Also, you're going to notice some audio challenges, but I promise you that together, you, the listener, and I, we will get through it. Let's do a deep dive.
Dr. LaChapelle, hello, welcome. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Sure, no problem. I'm actually super excited that you're here. So the benefit is all mine. You've written two books, Proud to be an Okie and I'd Fight the World, that one, are both incredibly well-researched and well-written, and two, are unputdownable if history, politics, or country music are of interest to someone, like me. I learned so much from reading these, and I'm glad to have you here. And I should preface by saying, forgive me if I come off a bit like a kid in a candy store, but I've just got so many questions for you.
That's fine.
Good. And the first one is, what's your favorite genre or generation of country music? Like, who are some of your favorite artists?
Oh, my favorite. Well, you know, I'm a little bit partial to the 70s, I guess being a child of the 70s. And, you know, just and one of the artists I was lucky enough to meet and interview and got to know a lot about was Merle Haggard.
Oh, really?
Someone who I've always been super partial. Well, just, you know, a fantastic songwriter, but also someone who, and lyricist, but also someone who really was, you know, proficient in multiple instruments and just, you know, his catalog just continues to impress me. So someone I've always kind of looked up to. And that's something I do talk about, you know, in the first book, Proud to Be an Okie. And he's kind of somewhat of an, his music and that genre, that era really is kind of somewhat of an endpoint for the story that I try to tell.
Yeah. It's like a bookend, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very similar. As a young kid, I was exposed to a very specific kind of country music in my house, probably more bluegrass and what would now be called Americana. That was in the late 70s and the early 80s. As I got a bit older, kind of into my teenage years, though, I noticed something in country music that I'll admit may have already existed in the mainstream of the genre. And you talk about this in your books. And I was maybe just becoming more aware of it, or maybe it really was a new, more visible thing in country music. And that is a more obvious conservative narrative in the music. And, you know, I always say that I didn't leave country music, that country music left me. But the more I think about it, I think your research has kind of hit home for me here, is that it wasn't that the music left me. I think what was really happening is that the people around me that were listening to contemporary country music at the time, and here I'm talking about like the early to mid 90s, were not really my people. You know, they weren't people I was particularly comfortable with. I think I was a bit of a weirdo. This is my teenage years, you know, grungy. I hung out with, you know, like an eclectic group of people, more into things like theater and academics. And the people listening to popular country music at the time were more gruff, maybe confrontational. You know, they bullied other kids, kind of drove big trucks. Is this resonating with you at all?
A little bit. And it makes me think of my own upbringing in Arizona. I grew up in a small town and really listened. I would feel in some ways really lucky that I was kind of exposed to 1970s AM adult contemporary radio. We had a local station that played such a wide variety of music. And I remember listening. I mean, one of the things that I grew up really listening to, Patsy Cline and Hank, the senior Hank Williams and folks like that, because they played them quite a bit on that station. And I think some of what resonates with me too, is that there was a time in my teen years where I really kind of wanted to leave that behind. And, you know, actually I just last night watched the Depeche Mode. I think they've remastered the, 1988 or 1989 documentary about their big American tour, right? Through the, you know, through all these, actually a lot of Southern and Southwestern cities. And, you know, I got me thinking a lot about that time period and, you know, again, myself kind of getting into other kinds of music and then also seeing the, what I saw in the 90s, especially, is the tilt towards, you know, more of the Daryl Worley and Toby Keith sort of politics of country music, right? That's sort of, you know, in your face and definitely kind of jingoistic and you know, at least kind of outwardly hawkish in some of the stances that were being taken. And then I mean, obviously we kind of move forward from that, we get to the Dixie Chicks with the whole, you know, in 2003 with the whole backlash against their music. And it did kind of cement in my mind that country music was a certain kind of thing. And then, you know, a certain kind of politics, right? And then I think as time went on, and especially as I kind of started writing about this, both I was writing as a journalist in Bakersfield, which is, you know, kind of major country music site. There once was there still is a fairly healthy country music culture. There was once even a little bit of an industry there, you know, with some record labels and things like that. And, you know, I started to kind of take a step back and really rethink that. And, you know, I'm in my position as a writer, I got to interview people like Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. And one of my favorites is Rose Maddox, who was quite a scream.
Really?
she for your listeners is, you know, a figure really came out of the 30s and 40s. And, you know, some of the folks who play rockabilly see her as a forerunner, because she kind of brought forward a style of playing, you know, what she would have called hillbilly music, that was really raucous. And she took stances. She did things with both her voice and on stage that really kind of pushed the boundaries of what people thought of as acceptable for women at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's jump back in time then. And this is probably specific most to like Proud to Be an Okie, is where you, and I mentioned that bookend where, you know, you kind of begin your analysis with the history of anti-migrant attitudes towards Okies, which is, in a nutshell, a derogatory term for poor migrants out of Oklahoma into California around about the 1930s. And this history is absolutely new to me, but the images you reference in the book, Proud to Be an Okie, definitely throw me back to the images I remember seeing growing up. And what I'm talking about here are like the classic image of a, you know, a shoeless hobo, quote unquote, an unkempt woman in the dirt surrounded by children. And it really has made me think about how images like these shape our formative and social development and maybe our politics. And I always took these images as true representations or depictions of, you know, like shared experiences across the entirety of America. But what you talk about is that these images actually reflect an othering of folks. And that does change some things for me. So I guess I'm wondering, am I just incredibly naive, or is there a reworked historical narrative here that is just slipping past everyone?
Well, I would say it's not reworked. It's complicated. And, you know, I think that like a lot of the representations you're talking about come out of John Steinbeck and The Grapes of Wrath, or, you know, Dorothea Lange's photography, which is, you know, amazing in its own right and something that should be studied. And you're right. I think a lot of these folks were trying to sort of depict the migrants. And in this case, we're talking people coming out of Oklahoma and Arkansas, you know, as well as, you know, parts of Texas and Missouri, areas around that Dust Bowl area that moved out to California en masse, right, in the 30s and continued to do so into the 40s and 50s. A lot of them, you know, escaping either the drought if they were farmers, or in many cases, the Depression itself. They might have been working in small towns or blue collar or, you know, small shop sort of positions, and they just found there was no work and they ended up moving to California. And I think when, you know, these outsiders come in, like Steinbeck and Lange, their goal partly was to represent the, you know, United States as a whole. But I think there was a parallel story going on, especially in California, probably also to some degree in Washington State and other places, Oregon, among local residents, that these people were interlopers, that they were coming there to take advantage of local welfare systems, and that they really contributed nothing good to the local economy or to the culture, that sort of thing. And what's interesting to me is I kind of delved into this and looked more and more at these sorts of representations, which were often parallel to these more popular attempts, right? Is the way race kept coming into it, and the way that, you know, they would almost depict these individuals as having, you know, racial characteristics and that were different than other white Protestants. And I found that really fascinating and kind of disturbing. And then I also found on the other side, you know, John Steinbeck, before he wrote The Grapes of Wrath, he wrote a pamphlet called Their Blood is Strong. Part of his argument was, well, these are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. We should welcome them and accept on the kind of racist line that here's a group of people that are worthy, right? other groups who were now, you know, expelling, such as the Mexican Americans, right? Mexican Americans in Southern California were, at, you know, in the late 30s, there was even an attempt to quote unquote repatriate people and send them to Mexico, even though they never lived there. And, you know, this was kind of a conversation that was going on at the time. And, you know, it fit in also with a larger story that sort of middle class reformers were had kind of in many cases had accepted a line about really comes out of the eugenics movement, though, that poor white people are inferior, and that they were, you know, that there was improper breeding and all kinds of this sort of, you know, notions of stock and race and that sort of thing going on. And that this explained generation after generation of criminality, right? Mm-hmm. And so kind of really digging deep into some of those images, you know, I think you hear even like a Caldwell's Tobacco Road, you know, and that it really shaped kind of the sense at the time, at least that, you know, among those people reacting to the migration in those, the endpoint states, that, you know, I think it says something about the character of kind of othering and looking at outsiders, right? That I don't think is as readily apparent in those sort of, you know, more kind of bigger New Deal sort of images.
You know, I guess I want to follow this line as it relates to, you know, race, because I'm struck by how country music has incorporated, you know, many elements over time to include more women's voices and also some rock pop influences. But when it comes to Black influence, there still seems to be some resistance, you know, and some examples, I suppose, recently would be Alan Jackson walking out on Beyonce's CMA performance.
Yeah.
The response to Lil Nas X's CMA win for Old Town Road. So I wonder how this has evolved over time. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, there certainly is a little bit more acceptance of this, you know, and I kind of use the Ken Burns documentaries as my barometer here. I don't know if I should, but
Well, I have questions about that too. So go ahead.
But, you know, as again, you know, I think of you thinking of maybe him playing a position that Steinbeck did and being a interpreter of something for the masses, right? And of kind of setting the standard for the establishment.
We're talking about Burns.
Ken Burns, the filmmaker, yeah. And people did know that in the documentary, you know, he did mention the West African origins of things like the banjo, but, you know, he kind of slipped over this really interesting, strong tradition of, I would say there's two things that, you know, and probably I could ask my group of, you know, scholarly friends that study this stuff and they'd find even more. But I would say, you know, one is the Black fiddling tradition, which was very strong. And there was a tradition of, you know, going well all the way back to plantations and slavery of having usually a male slave, you know, kind of serve a role as a fiddler for the, you know, often, certainly the slaves themselves, the enslaved, were enjoying the music, but they were often also performing for the masters, right? Then you also have a really strong string band tradition that country music really draws from. And in the case of the fiddlers, they were asked often to play these, you know, quote unquote, Anglo-Celtic, you know, fiddle reels and tunes. And in some ways kept that memory alive, right? Of maybe, you know, something brought over from Scotland or whatever it might've been. And then you have the role of these string bands in places like Memphis that were really innovating and trying new things with you know, guitar and sort of jug band style music that were also kind of, in a sense, preserving and innovating on country music. And none of that story gets told there, right? And I think that, and I'm not picking on Ken Burns because I know he's telling a very large story and he has a limited amount of time to do that.
Right.
But I think that's a larger issue within the country music culture, the industry, the performers, is that there's a sort of this acknowledgement that Black music has always been there and been influential and important. And yet it never seems to like take a center role in the way that we kind of construct our narratives about this. And so, you know, and one thing I've been kind of looking into lately, so I write a lot in my second book about George Wallace and the way he used country music for, geez, years and years and years, decades of gubernatorial and presidential campaigns.
Right.
And most of them, not all of them, near the end he changed a little bit, but most of them, you know, to prop up a kind of segregationist vision of either his state of Alabama or the nation. And you know, one of the things I found really, and that I kind of been doing some research on is, you know, one of the performers who ended up performing probably the most, Billy Grammer, had a song that really, you know, that he performed Gotta Travel On, right? And he, this song, I kind of trace the roots of it, and it goes back to the blues tradition. W.C. Handy writes about it in his memoir. And the tune itself goes back to a spiritual that we documented back to at least the 1860s. And, you know, and yet here he is playing this song every single day, you know, that he went out and campaigned for George Wallace, the biggest segregationist in the country.
Right.
And he never really admitted that. Like, I noticed that when the press talked about the song, they would mention that he thought it had some roots in Scotland. And, you know, I'm sure he was aware of at least some of this lineage. And, you know, it was kind of a knowing sort of omission going on there. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. But I do find this happening, you know, and I agree that like the reaction to Lil Nas X, you know, bothered me a lot, too, because in a lot of ways, the themes, and certainly I know he built, you know, sort of the lyrical structure, the narrative of the song around a video game. Interesting in itself. And my sons play that game and love it. So there's a lot of conversations in the family about that game. But in some ways, the song, it has more elements of country and themes, right? Kind of historical thematic elements than a lot of what sort of you hear on, you know, country FM radio these days. And yet, you know, there was the reaction to sort of like dechart him and to get sponsors to no longer, you know, claim him as one of their spokespeople and that sort of thing.
When you say roots in country themes, you mean like traditional roots, right?
Yeah, I mean, both, though, you know, and I think one of the things that, you know, is coming out right now and is the extent to which, you know, I think. So here's an issue is I call this the OCP syndrome, which is the only Charlie Pride syndrome that for decades, the country music industry acted as though the only African-American person really interested in performing country music was Charlie Pride. And that just wasn't true. There were all kinds of performers. And there's some scholars today working on, I'm not necessarily going in that direction right now, but uncovering, you know, all of these other performers who were trying to make it, but just couldn't get that support, especially because radio, and still remains pretty important, radio really wasn't open to these sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's an interesting, there's a lot going on. Now, certainly all these performers will talk about how they learned to play guitar from, you know, maybe a local African-American man who performed, or, you know, that's a very common theme that you'll see in when you start reading like country music memoirs and autobiographies and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit. In Proud to Be an Okie, you start your analysis in like Bakersfield, in California, LA, with Woody Guthrie. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, what I think would be a natural comparison in the realm of country music, like deep dives, if you will, which is Ken Burns' country music documentary, where he starts from a different place, which is like hill country music.
Yeah.
And then there's also the Nashville music scene. And so I guess I'm just wondering, is there a convergence across all three wherein the music is essentially at its heart the same, or did they all start from very clear divergent places and then converge at a later space?
So that's a complicated question.
Yeah.
You know, I think it kind of, you know, we use these terms like Anglo-Celtic ballads or whatever, right? Which is, you know, kind of the old fashioned sort of way of understanding the origins of country music. And certainly there is a very strong, I don't think anyone can doubt that within the Appalachian Mountains in particular, and then as another kind of, you know, I would call a little island of mountains is the Ozarks, which people sometimes neglect, but these two mountain ranges, you did have, you know, sort of Scots, Irish folks settling and bringing their musical traditions and all of that. And you do have these kind of strong traditional connections there. It doesn't mean, though, you know, at the same time, I mean, one of the instruments that comes out in this, obviously, we talked about earlier, is the banjo, right? Which mm-hmm. is, you know, a West African, the banjar, which is a West African instrument. You know, so that's what they're playing. They eventually are switching and playing eventually, you know, as time goes on. It's kind of interesting to chart, you know, which instruments were the most, when the fiddle was dominant, when was it the banjo, when was it the guitar, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting kind of issues of commerce and often race involved in all those things. But I think that, so you have that tradition, and that's often what historians have, you know, looked at, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what we're finding is that just like Woody Guthrie's repertoire, right? It was not one or the other. There was always vaudeville influences. There was always Tin Pan Alley influences. I don't necessarily have to get in the definitions of these, but, you know, pop influences. And there were other influences as well. I think, you know, especially when you get to kind of the cowboy themes, the Western wear, you know, that's representing a different kind of music making tradition that grew up independently of all of that. And then of course Hollywood jumps on that, and then it romanticizes it and creates its own kind of, you know, both attempts at realism, but attempts at fakery, pop lore, right? Archie Greene would call it, you know, where not folklore, but pop lore, right? Where we're creating a fake, mm-hmm. real folk tradition, right? And all of these things are constantly in play with one another. And certainly with the Western tradition, you know, you can't neglect the Mexican American influence and Mexican influence. And even, you know, I think to some degree, the extent to which the guitar becomes a dominant instrument in country music eventually. So, you know, I've always kind of seen it as not these things as being necessarily separate, but as kind of constantly bumping into each other and transforming each other. And, you know, so that, I hate to say, be the historian who always says is like, it's more complicated than that, but it is right. Right. There's a lot going on now. And that also, you know, we can talk about the influence of the blues. If you listen to Jimmy Rogers, who a lot of people kind of, you know, the traditional way is he's the father of country music or whatever. Well, he was the first radio star. I think you could probably argue that. And at least sustained radio, you know, there were other people fiddling John Carson, who had some radio appearances, and the Carter family, who later on did quite well. And, mm-hmm. you know, he really, really did. And what was he playing? I mean, he took the yodel, right, which we think came from a Tyrolese yodeling group that came over and from Northern Italy and performed in the South. And that got popularized, and then local people tried to start doing it. And then he also, you know, essentially he was playing, you know, a 12 bar blues sort of pattern. And, you know, it's hard to say he wasn't getting that from listening to a lot of blues music, African American blues music. It's, you know, I think it's these categories that the industry has put on the music from time to time are imprecise, and they should be seen as what they are, which is marketing categories. So one time they called it old time music, and then they called mm-hmm. it hillbilly music, and then they called it country and Western. And they, you know, scrambled for different names and eventually got rid of Western because that wasn't seen as cool anymore, right? And as the kind of Hollywood Western started to wane in popularity, you know, you see the industry kind of detaching itself, even though for a very long time, the industry was always the radio industry, the Grand Ole Opry would always welcome people like Gene Autry and Roy Rogers and these Hollywood cowboys on to perform.
At the nexus where country music and politics converge, and maybe more recently, it's more so the case that country, well, I guess the question is it more so the case that country music has changed or that our politics or our political parties have changed? And I guess what I'm getting at is the original listener base, which was, you know, lower income, lower educated, the same now as it was then?
That's a difficult question. I do think that there is some truth to the argument that there has been a suburbanization of the country music audience, meaning I think now if you looked at like the country broadcast radio organization, if you look at their statistics, you're going to see that, you know, compared to, I know the original study back in the 70s, I think it was Richard Peterson, one of the sociologists who studied country music for a long time. You know, they essentially made that kind of argument that it was a lower income audience. And I think that was probably true for the time period. But I do think that that audience has grown and expanded into the middle class. It doesn't mean that there wasn't a middle class audience all along. I mean, one of the interesting things that I'm also trying to like figure out is this weird dichotomy, going back to the 30s and 40s, of where you had one group of performers really pushing the line of, increasingly in the 40s and 50s, of the drinking and cheating sort of, you know, stereotypical country song. And at the same time, there's a whole nother group of performers and radio personalities, you know, including, you know, at that time they were more announcers, MCs of programs, because disc jockeys didn't quite exist yet. Mm-hmm. But we're pushing the idea that country music was clean, godly music, and that, you know, it's I find like strange things, you know, as a historian. Like one of my favorite political country music, I guess you can call him a performer, at least he was a songwriter, was Pappy O'Daniel, right? Governor of Texas in the 30s, mm-hmm. who gets kind of characterized in the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou movie, right? Coen Brothers. And he was an interesting figure, but I found this fascinating article from 1945. You know, he ran for governor and kind of, you know, I'm going to support the Ten Commandments, but I'm also against capital punishment. You know, it's kind of weird, sort of populist platform that he ran on. And he used he created his own band, the Hillbilly Boys, that included two of his sons playing banjo and fiddle. And when he did this, what's interesting is in 1945, when he was a senator, he was complaining to the press that a lot of the military bases were, you know, becoming dens of inequity because there were little booze dives set up around them. And he argued that a soldier should take, you know, a banjo or fiddle with them so they can sit back at the base during their free time and practice and perform, like his son was, supposedly. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Instead of going out drinking. And he saw, you know, country music as a force that would kind of uphold some sort of moral purity, right?
This jumps out at me as well in both of your books, but it does strike me, and correct me if I'm wrong, the trajectory of country music, you know, it does seem to coincide with the trajectory of evangelical religion in the States, you know, as it moved from focusing on issues like charity and poverty to an emphasis on things like morals or traditional marriage, prohibition, and that later country music seems to have embraced this idea that the very things that earlier country music championed, like charity and government assistance for vulnerable folks, those things became things that should be scorned, like welfare. And then as that happened, country music seemed to stop being music that spoke for working class folks and more for the kind of religious middle and upper class. And I know, again, there's a lot to unpack here, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Oh, boy.
yeah.
No, I mean, I think there's a grain of truth there, which is that, you know, certainly you don't see performers. I know there was an age of performer. I think Minnie Pearl's an interesting one who, you know, talks in her autobiography about having the stereotypical portrait of FDR up on the family mantle, right? That this was probably pretty common for many of these performers. And it was interesting, you know, it's interesting too to see how they kind of navigate folks like Richard Nixon, who at times is really pushing this traditional values narrative, but also a very different kind of politics about economics than most of them had traditionally. And so I think there's a kind of interesting falling out where some, like Ernest Tubb, really hated Nixon. Mm-hmm. And some of these other performers started to kind of embrace him in different ways. You know, I think there's some truth there. And I think it's interesting to say, like, the issue of a song, if a song, someone came out with a song today about charity, I don't think that necessarily would have trouble getting played on the radio, right? I don't think there would be objections to that. I do think that there has been kind of a shutting down of discussion of things like welfare, you know, which kind of makes me think, you know, if you kind of want to put a dot on your dateline, I'd say 1970, when, you know, Guy Drake came out with a song that became a reasonable hit, Welfare Cadillac, right? Which kind of criticized people for, you know, accepting all kinds of assistance, school lunch, whatever, while they also drove like a brand new fancy Cadillac. So it's that sort of stereotype. And the question is, I don't know, like, there are some conversations that it seems like are less likely to happen now. I do think, though, we don't want to oversimplify it, because there's always been pressure on performers. You know, going back, Roy Rogers in the 40s was wrote about this, is, you know, that if you take one position, then you potentially alienate half your audience, right? And so that still comes into play. But, you know, it does seem like the industry does, when it comes to more liberal positions, either it discourages, well, we don't talk about politics, but when it comes sometimes to the more right-wing or conservative positions, or maybe positions that performers on that side are taking outside of their music, right, in terms of, you know, their online, their social media activity, that kind of thing, there's a tendency to kind of look the other way, right, in those cases. It's kind of a selective scrutiny
yeah,
going on. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I think it's, you know, certainly there are powerful players. I know we've had a lot of discussion of, you know, we did this interview right after the Texas school shootings. Mm-hmm. The, you know, the issue of the NRA being involved in promoting and using country music, that's, you know, something that's going on for a couple of decades at least, with a wing of that organization called NRA Country, which has promoted the careers of many up and coming artists. And, you know, they're not expected necessarily to toe an exact party line, but they're expected to sort of generally support the message of the NRA if they're among that group of, you know, if they're kind of selected for that lineup. And I mean, some of this started, you know, going back to the 70s with Roy Rogers was one of the first one spokespeople from the country music industry to represent the NRA. And he right. helped defeat a big gun control measure in California that the NRA spent, I think at the time, about $5 million on.
There is a subgenre of country that feels like it doesn't fit into this narrative as neatly, you know, the transformation of moving from a you know, country music representing more of a working class liberal base to a much more conservative, and that is bluegrass. And, you know, I think of maybe artists like the Stanley Brothers or Emmy Lou Harris or Alison Krauss. It seems to me like there's always been a liberal through line in bluegrass. And maybe some more recent bands would be like Old Crow Medicine Show or Mumford and Sons. And I guess I'm wondering, am I drawing a spurious conclusion here, or is the tradition of bluegrass maybe different?
Well, I think you could find artists in bluegrass that on both sides there. And there certainly is a very strong, if you want to talk about the connection with gospel music and, you know, sort of a country style gospel, is bluegrass has a very strong, if you listen to bluegrass radio, you're going to hear a lot of gospel today anyways. You know, that said, you know, yeah, there has been a connection. I mean, I think one thing I've noticed in general about bluegrass is there's less likelihood. I mean, people aren't coming out as often with really strident positions in the bluegrass industry, but, you know, there have been examples of people doing that. You know, I'm trying to think like back to there were some bluegrass artists who came out in the Vietnam War era, you know, as kind of opposing the war. And there has been you know, I mean, often because of where bluegrass has been located geographically, you know, again, connected to those Appalachian mountain ranges, there, you know, there has been an affinity historically with the Democratic Party and a tendency to support Democratic candidates. Probably not true necessarily anymore, but yeah, I mean, I do think that once you kind of get outside of those people who grew up with it, but maybe were rather living in other places, maybe some suburbs or urban places, and got interested in bluegrass, that, you know, the potential for the music to be used politically in all kinds of directions sort of opened up in a way too, you know. So
take a breath, because my next question is a big one. So how do you see country music evolving in the Trump era of politics? And the reason I'm asking is, it's probably not controversial to say that our politics are once again becoming tinged with racial overtones. We're definitely seeing the empowerment of white supremacist organizations again. How do you, if at all, see this reflected in the country music industry now or over time?
Well, I mean, I guess the best I can speak to that is, you know, just some recent events and then, you know, some general characterizations. I do think there are people like, I'm thinking here of Eric Church, who have, you know, come out, Eric Church, about the issue, especially after the shooting here in Las Vegas a few years ago, and questioning some of the NRA's positions and doing this publicly. And, you know, I think there are some performers that they're at a position in their career where they feel empowered to kind of do that. And Tim McGraw, that's who I was trying to think of earlier, who are kind of, you know, challenging this idea that country music is inevitably conservative or supporting a kind of right-wing populism of the sort of Trump variety, right? I do think that, you know, that a lot of folks are just afraid to say anything. And this is something, you know, going back to the 2016 election where The Guardian went and interviewed all these people in Nashville and no one would tell them anything about who they supported, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, the old standbys, you know, you could get the people that supported every Republicans all the way back to the Bushes or whatever. They'll come out and talk about it, right? But they're not really worried about, you know, their careers or their legacies at this point, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting. I do think that you're seeing a new thing where, you know, on one level, you have like leaders in the field, such as Jason Aldean, right?
Who I think often in his music,
I mean, he's avoiding politics, generally speaking, or if he is dealing with it, it's kind of in more indirect sort of ways. Mm-hmm. And yet on his social media, you know, he or his wife are out, you know, kind of pushing causes that some people are really wondering about, you know.
And kind of in your face too, very confrontational about it.
Confrontational. And I think that is something kind of new and it is a little alarming. I think that, you know, that, and obviously this, when we talk about these folks and their families, we have to kind of consider this as part of a public image, a persona that's, you know, if you look at some of these top performing artists, they basically have a variety of people helping them and serving as handlers or as intermediaries or whatever, or, you know, or helping them in the studio or whatever it is. I mean, we have to kind of think of these artists almost as corporations. So, you know, they're making a calculated decision about who they think their audience is and how they will respond. And, you know, I think that's alarming, certainly. It's not, and then I hate to be the historian, it's not necessarily anything new. You know, I think we have, going back to the 30s, a lot of right-wing populism having associations with country music figures as well, like Huey Long. And I think of J.R. Brinkley in Kansas, who ran for governor of Kansas twice. He was the guy, you know, who had a Mexican border radio station that he used to circumvent U.S. broadcasting laws. And he would use a lot of country music. He would push a lot of quack cures for, you know, things like impotence. And you know, he constantly used country music artists to promote himself and his radio station and his political career. Roy Faulkner was one of the figures that I kind of dealt with a little bit in my more recent book. And again, you know, there is a long tradition of this. And I do think, here's the thing, I think there are a lot of parallels, I think, sometimes with the Huey Long situation, and that
was the governor of Louisiana.
And, you know, known for, really came in promoting himself as a reformer, which is, this is a long theme of this in the country music politicians that I kind of survey in the second book. I'm a reformer, right? I think of, you know, the "Oh, brother, where art thou" image of the politician up there with the broom. I'm going to sweep it clean, right? They even, several of these figures use mops, not brooms, but
right,
not Huey Long. But, you know, I'm going to clean things up. I'm going to bring a bucket of suds out and clean everything up, right? And then they get elected, they end up being more corrupt. And sometimes, especially in the South, you know, more racially divisive, even if they didn't originally present themselves as that, than their predecessors. And, you know, I think with the Huey Long and his hold and his machine, the machine that he built up, political machine that used corruption and kind of, you know, payoffs and expectations that state workers are going to contribute part of their salary as kind of a tribute fee to the organization. You know, that level of corruption and also sometimes fanaticism, it took a long time to unravel. And maybe the comparison I'm trying to make here is that there is no quick and easy solution here. I think that sort of unraveling this and getting people to take a step back and really look at what's happening is going to take time.
It's one thing to say, you know, like that's part of our history and it's part of our dead history, right? It's another to say like that's part of our history and we might be circling back. And I guess maybe what I'm getting at is Trump kind of pushed the boundary, I think, as to what was appropriate, as to how we associate and how we talk about certain things. And I think it's absolutely fair to say how we talk about white supremacy and race is one of those things. And I think politicians on the right at first were a little uncomfortable. And then you started to see them realize that that was a winning strategy for, you know, at least a certain contingent of the electorate. And I guess what I'm wondering is that possible that country music singers will also make that same connection?
That they will step back or that they will move?
That they'll see like, hey, actually this wouldn't hurt us to be a little more overt.
Yeah. And I think that is true. I mean, I think like, for instance, the example I mentioned with the NRA, that here's an opportunity for my career, right? Mm-hmm. And so if it's assured that I'm going to, you know, get, this is going to help my career, then maybe I'm going to step into it, even if I'm not a true believer, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, unfortunately, I think there is that potential. Now, there are also, I don't want to, you know, paint it all dark and negative here, but there is the possibility. There are a lot of people, if we're talking about Nashville as an industry, right? There are a lot of people pushing Nashville to make changes. And so one of the organizations, the Black Opry, which is, you know, right now it's, they're kind of trying to provide a performance venue for African-American artists, really having some successes and getting major industry players to listen to them and take them seriously. And, you know, it's still an uphill battle. And I think there's, you know, also the women of country music pushing against the fact that, you know, for at least in recent times, which is kind of shocking to think about, but it's been hard for women. It's been much harder for women to get radio airplay, and radio still remains pretty important. You know, I know a lot of other genres that radio maybe isn't very important at all anymore, but it is to the country. It is to having some success in the country genre. And, so, you know, there has been movements and strides in the right direction. Doesn't mean, though, necessarily that will continue. I mean, I do hope it does. And I think we need to support those people kind of trying to make those changes.
Okay. So I've got some questions that are not necessarily political, but I'm interested in picking your brain on.
Okay, sure.
Sure. So there have been some artists that could have drawn pop rock and or country into some interesting territory. Not to say that others haven't, but like, you know, I think of Mark Lindsay or the Byrds or Joe South, even Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Bob Dylan, John Denver. And I think they definitely did carve out a bit of a niche in, you know, their respective areas, but they only got so far. And then on the countryside, I imagine like Tammy Wynette or Loretta Lynn or Emmylou Harris, Johnny Cash, you know, all felt as if they could have landed in the pop world or at least carved out an entirely new niche there. And they each did have some limited crossover success with, you know, either one-off songs, you know, or an album here or there, but not like wholesale convergence across the genres. And so I'm wondering if you could imagine what happened there. Was there like no real commercial room for this, or was the industry itself just so categorized and compartmentalized that artists weren't encouraged, you know, or so there was no benefit to experimentation in this?
You know, I think some of the fault may lay in local radio programming directors and DJs who had a lot of control over what got out to the public, right? And I do think that probably there's a tendency to perhaps we'll play these records for a while and then we need to get back to our usual, you know, lineup. And so on the countryside, I kind of think that that might have come into play there, maybe more than you think, in getting the music out there. On the other side, I think, you know, if you think about country artists trying to kind of break into the pop market, I mean, that has happened recently quite a bit, both among kind of, you know, artists who are performing music that is closer to the pop genre or whatever. And then, you know, those who make full crossovers like Taylor Swift, you kind of, you know, impressively lines up the numbers there, right?
Even like Shania Twain, I suppose.
Or Shania Twain, yeah, earlier, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think that there is something to say. Now, it's interesting too, you know, some people would argue, well, there's a lot of folks who had really successful pop careers and are now moving to Nashville to try to rebrand themselves as country because, you know, maybe they're not getting the audience they used to with pop or whatever other genre they came from. Right. And so there is that idea. It doesn't necessarily mean it's easy
to right.
do that, and that everyone is going to be, you know, a Darius Rucker or whatever. Right?
Yeah. Brandi Carlile too.
Exactly. Yeah. So the genres, the boundaries still mean something, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know. I think that there is more crossover than there used to be. There's more room for crossover, but, you know, they're still there. Those boundaries are still there.
I think on some level, I'm lamenting the idea that there could have been an invention of an entirely new genre, you know, had we leaned a bit more into it.
Oh, so you're saying something like a country rock or country pop or...
Yeah, and outside of like honky-tonk or rockabilly, you know, like something entirely new and interesting.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting question. And I think maybe the, you know, part of what the issue always, I think, has to do with the structure, these kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. I don't think things necessarily like politics and racial attitudes are always, we can always lay the blame at the feet of the industry, but when it comes to issues like the genre or making room for a new genre, you know, I think the industry has a lot to do with that. It has to do with, you know, what existing formats are there for popularizing the music at any given historical period.
I don't know that this is still true, but I think Loretta Lynn talked a little bit about this as well, about, you know, the importance of DJs and making sure that her records comported with whatever it is that their sensibilities were at the time to ensure that they got played.
This is very true. And country music, I actually just had a really great Nashville-based journalist come to my class, well, actually come via Zoom to my class.
Mm-hmm, right.
To Marissa Moss. And she just came out with a book. So you should look up her book and support it.
There's a plug.
And she talked about this. And one of the things that doesn't exist in other genres is there are still these quote unquote country radio tours that are really important to the success of especially up middle level and up and coming artists. And they still go and travel from city to city, meeting with DJs and programming directors and other radio personnel. And part of the upshot of that, which he wrote about several years ago, is that there has been a really negative culture of sexual harassment associated with this, you know, which isn't good. I suppose what she would say is good, or at least an element of it is good, is that there is this sense that people know one another in the industry. Mm-hmm. There's kind of this closeness, right? And of course, that can be a good and a bad thing, right? I kind of use this metaphor that some of the writers about country music back in the 60s and 70s sometimes used about the industry's reaction to rock and roll, right? Circling the wagons, that there's this, oh, well, there's outsiders. We have to, this closeness means we're going to be exclusive, right? On the other hand, the closeness can be something really supportive too, to up and coming people. So it's an interesting kind of dichotomy. I mean, I think country music presents itself as being a friendlier space in some ways, mm-hmm. but also I think the reality is it also can be a space that's more, there's more potential for these kind of damaging relationships as well.
Is there space for someone like me who would consider themselves to be a liberal in country music? And if so, where is that?
Are you talking as a performer or as a listener?
Oh, I would love to be a performer. But for now, baby steps, a listener.
Okay, listener. Yeah, I think there is. And, you know, I mean, even in your mainstream country, I think there are artists who are, you know, I kind of mentioned some of the folks like Eric Church and Tim McGraw and some of these other folks. And certainly, you know, some of the folks who have been cast by the wayside, the Dixie Chicks, are still delving, you know, deep into the kind of the country tradition and genre in different kinds of ways, newer and innovative sort of ways. Mm-hmm. I think that there is, and there's still this growing field too, which has become kind of a subgenre of Americana, right? Which we used to call it back in the old days alt country because of the listservs. I think it will forget which one, AOL or what this had. I was on it, I think, back in the 90s.
Is that where the name came from? It's making sense now.
Yeah. That they, you know, and I think it associated maybe with the publication, the No Depression, right, which took its name from the Carter family and all that sort of thing. But, you know, they tried to connect themselves with a kind of history and a kind of roots. And are, you know, I think you have people like Jason, I'll make sure I pronounce his name right, Jason Isbell, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
From, you know, who's now a solo artist, but had a, you know, a pretty good career as part of a band there that played this music for many years. And he's very outspoken, you know, on his social media. And, you know, you've got all kinds of other, you know, Casey, I'm blanking on name.
Musgraves.
Yeah. You know, who's very outspoken. And and a lot of these folks have been, interestingly enough, have been really supportive, despite criticisms of the Americana industry. They've been very supportive of these up and coming African American artists. I know Isbell even has kind of served, he's volunteered or appeared as kind of a you know, an MC or show organizer in some of these events. So that's really fantastic. So the genre is not necessarily defined by what the mainstream industry thinks it is. And it's not necessarily defined as what, you know, a fan in state A might think or a fan in state B. I think we have to look to it to find those people and the kinds of stories and songwriting and music making that appeals to us. And there is a wide variety out there. And I suppose that's one thing, you know, and this is sort of some point the country radio industries will have to deal with the fact that more and more country listeners are not necessarily being introduced to the music via radio.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right.
And that may make changes. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't have the foresight. I'm a historian, so to predict the future there. But
okay. What's something interesting that you've been reading, watching, listening to, and or doing lately? And it does not have to be related to this topic.
Oh my goodness. I have been gardening a little bit, which is hard here in Las Vegas, but I'm doing some container gardening and enjoying that quite a bit, trying to learn.
What are you growing? What grows in Las Vegas?
Well, I started with herbs because they're easy and hard to kill.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to do, you know, the Three Sisters right now. I don't know. I've got this plan anyways, mm-hmm. which is the Three Sisters. It's a very historian right. sort of topic here, but it's doing beans and corn and squash, which comes from our indigenous traditions in North America of agriculture. So I'm trying that out, see what I can do with it.
Well, that's not container.
No, it's, I know. I don't know how. I'm not sure. I haven't done it, that part of it yet. I'm doing, you know, I have some cucumbers and peppers going, but yeah.
Yeah. I tried that once, the Three Sisters, and it did not work well for me.
It did not work.
No, yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. I think we should all be thinking about how we can feed ourselves. So,
yeah, it's fun anyways. It gets me out of the house a little bit. And I have this other crazy idea that I've been working on, which is a historical novel based to some degree on my grandfather's experiences, a grandfather who I really never got to meet, but I know the history, collected the history from the family, but who served in a squadron in the Navy in World War II, a naval air squadron that actually operated what they call K-class blimps. Mm-hmm. And off the eastern coast of the United States, eventually they moved to places like Morocco as the war progressed. They operated these blimps essentially to sight German U-boats and report them, sometimes actually even act, you know, against them and with depth charges and things. So My grandfather was part of that story. And it's got me thinking, like, this is a great story. And no one knows we even used lighter than air in World War II. I mean,
right.
Not no one, but you know, there's a few people.
Sure.
But it's such a great story. And there's a lot of like, you know, so I'm kind of thinking about using that basis and fictionalizing it and going in some new directions with
it. Well, that's you're a great storyteller. So I full-throatedly endorse that.
Okay, great. I will come back to you for a book endorsement when I'm done.
You had Harry Reid endorse I'd Fight the World, so I think you're in better company. Dr. LaChapelle, I've really enjoyed this conversation. You've given me a new lease on country music.
Okay, great.
Thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
There are a couple of things from this conversation that I want to provide a bit more information about. First, I had no idea about the Black Opry, so I've spent some time since this interview digging into it, and it's opened up a whole new musical world to me. And it's absolutely worth checking out and supporting if you're able and so inclined at blackopry.com. I've included a link in the show notes as well. Additionally, another new piece of information to me is that the National Rifle Association supports some country artists that are expected to, in return, in some form or another, also support the National Rifle Association. It's an arm of the NRA called NRA Country. After the Parkland shooting in 2019, a list of NRA country performers was removed from the NRA Country website, so it became invisible to viewers. But some of the partner artists include Luke Bryan, Blake Shelton, and Thomas Rhett, Florida Georgia Line, Charlie Daniels, Luke Combs, Hank Williams Jr., Travis Tritt, and the Gatlin Brothers. This is being recorded a few days after the Texas Republican Party released its platform, and it's pretty, I don't know, shocking? And not because some fringe extremists are running around spouting this stuff, but because it's an actual formal platform that the Republican Party in Texas has endorsed. Here are a couple of planks from that platform. The party endorses the fact that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president. He is not. That Texas should vote to secede. I say, please, go. And they reference homosexuality as, quote, an abnormal lifestyle choice. While I have talked to folks about this last plank before on this podcast, about the Republican Party's renewed attacks on the queer community this year, it is worth mentioning that the vast majority of the public is accepting of queer folks, support same-sex marriage, and do not approve of discrimination based on sexuality or sexual orientation. So the Republican Party's platform this year is an unexpected body blow to the queer community, not just because it's effectively the demonization of a marginalized community, but also because it stands in such contrast to general public opinion on these questions. It makes me wonder if they actually stand to gain any traction on this. So next week, I'm talking to Dr. Paul Brewer at the University of Delaware, He's a researcher and expert on queer rights, public opinion, and how the media and politicians can influence that public opinion. As always, in the meantime, you can email me at deepdivewithsean@gmail.com with any thoughts or questions. Follow me on Twitter at deepdivesean and on Instagram at deepdivewithsean. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, please feel free to follow it on the platform of your choosing or give it a like. And if you have any friends that might be interested, let them know about this podcast too. It really helps to get the word out. Chat soon, folks.